I am from beyond. Listen, and all you desire will be yours. Welcome to Spider-Dan and the Secret Wars. Prepare for battle.
It was a defensive exercise.
Yeah, best defense is a good offense. Or is it the other way around?
Welcome to Prattleworld. I'm your host, the ever-amazing, ever-spectacular Spider-Dan. And in this podcast, I spotlight entertainment's best-kept secrets that a mainstream audience may find boring. Welcome back, guys, to another edition of Secret Defenders, where I bring on guests to talk about the lesser-known films that they love, or cult films, or films that the general public just don't really like that much. So I have another podcast extraordinaire with me today who's going to talk about a very unique film. It is Dan Velasquez. Welcome.
Hello, Dan. I thought, you know, you obviously don't have enough Dans to appear on this program, and I thought I would just add to that.
We've had three D's on this program now, including yourself. Triple D's, which sounds dirtier than I meant it to be. but we're here today. So before we get stuck into the film you're going to talk about, I won't mention it just yet. I'd just like to talk about you and talk about how we know each other and how long we've known each other.
Charming. Well, Dan, I've had the pleasure of knowing you for nigh on a decade, I think.
Was it that long?
It's not quite that long,
no,
don't worry.
Close.
But, you know, it's in kind of geological terms.
Am I the old fossil or you?
Oh, thanks, definitely me. By the way, as the listeners may be aware, I've been a little bit ill.
Week or so,
which has tragically delayed the recording of this, which we've both been very much looking forward to.
Oh, very much.
And I'd just like to apologise in advance if there's an occasional moment where I might have a little cough.
We will forgive you, Dan, because I know it's been quite harrowing for you to be this ill. So, but we'll carry on regardless.
It's been a tough one.
How did we meet?
Well, I am a writer and a blogger and a podcaster, as you've mentioned, but I also, kind of in a previous life, have a bit of an acting career behind me. Mm-hmm. And we worked together on a few productions, I think.
We did. We were in Harvey. That was the first one.
That was a wonderful, little show. Yeah, I didn't play a doctor. I played the judge.
Yes, you played a lovely Scottish judge.
Yeah.
Quite eccentric, I remember.
There were lots of different nationalities in that play, because you played the English sort of doctor who was the head of the mental hospital.
I think it was the closest I've ever come to playing like a hero or like a kind of a charming lead.
Quite the dashing guy, absolutely. Whereas I was the judge who I decided to play as Scottish. There were
you know what it reminded me of quite a bit was Edward Woodward in The Wicker Man, which I know you're a fan of.
That probably was an influence on the voice, to be fair. and I think I just chose to do it with an accent because it might make it, because the thing about Harvey is it's an American play and nominally set in America, but we're obviously not Americans, and
clearly not,
but I don't think we really decided where it was set.
No,
still references in the script to places like Pasadena.
We changed some references to like something, or we tried to make it out like it was somewhere in England, or it was the name of a mental facility or something like that.
But I do remember that I kind of argued that we should change Pasadena to Saint Anne's, or Saint Anne's.
Yeah, that's my hometown.
But is that really?
Yeah, it's my hometown.
Wow, I did not know that then.
Yeah, I was born in Blackpool, but I mostly live in Lytham St Anne's. Well, my family lives in Lytham St Anne's. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
I would have agreed with that.
Me up on that one then when I made the.
I should have.
Because obviously nobody else listened to me and it didn't amp.
So that was one of like several kind of plays that you were kind of involved with that were kind of based off movies, weren't they? So Harvey was a play but then made into a movie.
Yeah. Well, they weren't all movies, strictly speaking, but they might have been from TV or comic books or things like that.
There was
The Ballad of Halo Jones, which was a 2000 AD comic book.
Alan Moore one.
These were all in Manchester, by the way, at a venue which I'm not going to mention because it's no longer there.
Yeah, it doesn't exist, sadly.
They did a lot of sitcoms. There was The Good Life and Porridge and things like that. All done with kind of permission and arrangement with the writers. And it was a really exciting little time of doing theatre that was not quite normal theatre in a way, because it was taking inspiration from a different place, whether be it comics or... We also did some adaptations of the horror writer Simon Clarke.
Okay.
Of his stories. We also did, you know, like any theatre, we did original things. But, I mean, we tried to keep even the original things kind of within the genre of appeal that would give them something in common with the other stuff we were doing. So, you know, we did like Centurion, which was like alien-esque, haunted house in space.
Nice.
Kind of thing. We did that at Fab Cafe, actually, which is still there.
That's good. One of my night spots when I go out. I frequent there.
Okay.
I won a Batman quiz there on Batman Day last year.
What's Batman Day?
Batman Day. Oh, what date is it? I don't know what date it is, but it's basically a celebration of Batman.
Well,
his is 80th birthday this year.
Right.
80 years of Batman, believe it or not. Anyway, before we get started, I want to ask one more thing. Is there anything you're currently involved in? Any work you're doing that you'd like to promote? Any social media handles you use?
Well, certainly. Thanks for the opportunity. Well, as I mentioned, I'm a writer and a blogger, and I've got a blog called Life is About Fiction, which is just me musing about various fictional things which interest me. The main thread of it to start with was me deciding that I need to finally watch every Shakespeare play in some form, whether it was a film or whether it was an actual play, but not read it. That's the key thing, you know.
To see if you like understand it, you get it, or if it's a good adaptation.
And on the principle that he wasn't writing for people to read.
No, true.
So I started that, but it kind of branched out into other things. So that's Life is About Fiction at WordPress.com. And on Twitter, it's Life is About Fic. Also, I review audio dramas for thedigitalfix.co.uk. Mainly kind of sci-fi stuff. I reviewed one of the Alien Audible dramas.
Is that the one by one of them by Dirk Maggs? Is it Dirk Maggs?
Yes. I think he produces and writes all of them.
Mm.
And I reviewed the first one he did. The middle one. I reviewed Alien River of Pain.
Okay.
Which is the sort of prequel to the movie Alien.
Okay.
Which is very interesting.
Sounds good.
The other two I haven't reviewed, but I have heard them all, and they are all very good. I'm hoping they're just about to release another one, but they haven't told anyone because it is Alien Day now.
That's right,
the 26th of April.
They've been releasing like some shorts, I think, some movie shorts on like YouTube.
Yes, because it is the 40th anniversary this year of the original Alien film. And an amazing piece of kind of corporate skullduggery, which is the kind of thing you do when you're in a massive corporation which is undergoing a merger and is all kind of possible.
Oh, of course, yeah.
They couldn't make a film or anything kind of majorly significant.
So
essentially got some alien funds to make 10 short films. And I've seen three of them. And
to be honest, who better to make those films than the fans?
Yes. At least one of them that I've seen is really good.
I'm going to give them a watch, I think.
Yeah. So, no,
I might have to do something on aliens maybe at some point in the future.
Oh, please do. And please give me a call if you do, because I can talk and talk and talk. Aliens is one of my three favourite films. You've mentioned one of my other three, which is The Wicker Man already. And my third favourite film is With Nail and I.
With Nail and I, good choice.
Again, we're both acting backgrounds.
Yeah,
we can relate a great deal.
Definitely, definitely. And you are a big Hammer horror fan as well, aren't you?
Yes, we talked before on our podcast stuff on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Which podcast is that?
Well,
do some more promoting.
Yes, no, absolutely. I'm getting around to it. Yes, so you and I have another friend who's an actor called Howard Witter. Mm-hmm. He was in Harvey with us. I think he was doing an American accent.
Yes, he was the only
person in the cast.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why after we did that show, my brother came up to me and said, you know, I watched the film Harvey the other day, and I thought, it makes more sense this, because it's clearly set in America. It's not set in Scotland, Australia, England, and several other places like the one you did. So I was like, okay. But, well, no, yeah, me and Howard are both kind of huge fans of British horror films Hammer films in particular, and our favourite actors or two of them are Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. So we did a podcast called the Lee Cushing Podcast about that. That kind of went away because our host website went away.
No.
So we then kind of reinvented it into a thing called And Now the Podcast Starts, where we talk a little bit more broadly about horror, which is where we brought you and Dan to talk about the first couple of Halloween films.
Yes, we did.
Lots of recorded podcasts about the entire series of Halloween films, which will be coming out, but probably not until we have successfully relaunched And Now the Podcast Starts properly.
Yes, on a new platform.
It's going to be a totally new platform. It's going to be me and Howard and a couple of other co-hosts and guests, hopefully such as yourself.
Oh, yes, I'd love to. I'd love to.
We're just narrowing down the format for it at the moment, which is why we're not quite ready to launch it. But one thing I am ready to launch, which I would love to talk about, is a new podcast which starts on May the 1st called The Faces at the Window.
Ooh.
It's derived from a Manchester sketch comedy group who basically do stage sketch shows with songs in them, comedy songs, and we've reinvented it as basically an audio sketch podcast. But we wanted to do something which we thought no one has done before, and which kind of exploits the medium of podcasts, if possible. So what we're going to do is release a new sketch or song, or maybe a couple every day for a month. So there's essentially 31 episodes starting on the 1st of May, and that's a Podbean podcast.
Oh, good, good. My host.
God bless Podbean.
I mean, it's easy. It's good to use. I mean, I've got no problem with Podbean whatsoever. I think they're great, and I've had no issues whatsoever with Podbean. Just learning how to do it, mostly, once I had that down. It's all good.
And they are in no way paying you to say that, that's right.
No, they are not. I'm actually paying them.
Yeah.
I'm actually paying them use their services, but it is a good service, and it's well worth the money.
No, it is really good. Other podcast hosting services are available.
Yes, they are available.
But that others may be more expensive or less user
possibly
friendly.
And
so it's worth recommending Podbean.
Podbean connects to a lot of other things like YouTube and Spotify kind of almost seamlessly. You can take, I mean, I've got it on, it's on my podcast on various things: YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, all these different platforms, many more that I probably can't remember, but it's out there. But no, I like Podbean as a host as they go. But again, like you said, many more available, and they might suit different people. So if you are creating a podcast, do some research, much like I did.
Yes, and they have fun like what we're having now. The Face of the Window starts on the 1st of May, which is maybe around now. I don't know when this episode
is. Probably around the 1st of May, I'm going to say.
And you can easily find us. Our website is thefacesatthewindow.com. We're on Twitter at The Window Faces, and Facebook and Instagram and all that. It'll be basically all over once it kicks off. And it should be really fun. Because I can say that because although I did have some writing involvement, lots of it I did not write. And I've listened to it and I think it's great.
Still hilarious.
It really makes me laugh.
Good.
And it's very, there's some absolutely, well, I think there's at least a couple, I don't want to blow my own trumpet.
Yeah.
But there's at least a couple of, even though I have no involvement in the sketches I'm talking about, but I think there's at least a couple of great sketches in there that are like classics.
Really?
Every day is going to have some good stuff. We've been working on this material for a long time and testing it in front of audiences. Something and it's now just we just wanted to put it up somewhere where it can get a wider audience because we've never really been outside of the north of England, really.
Fair enough. So for my next question is, where do you find the time
to do all these things? I don't know. It's called being unemployed now. Although I'm only recently unemployed, actually, so yeah, it's been...
It's a voluntary unemployment.
Yeah, it actually is. Basically, I used to work a long way away from where I live, and I could have carried on working there, but the travels were really wearing me down. I think it may have contributed, not to my illness, but to the fact that I just got so run down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Various viruses or whatever.
If you're on a public transport for too long and frequently enough, you're probably going to catch something.
Yes. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Next thing on the agenda, learn to drive to avoid this problem. The question of where I get the time is, I don't know. And I've always planned more things than I could possibly achieve.
Yes.
And that basically translates as throwing loads of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. Some of it you'll get through. Face at the Window, I'm very excited about because we have been working on it for years and it's coming to fruition now.
Fantastic.
And it's going to be a complete thing. It's not like, oh, we're starting a new podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
We might do a few episodes.
It might happen.
We've done
maybe
a whole series.
Yeah. It's ready. It's there. Yeah. It's just scheduling the releases.
Yeah, you're not going to murder me before I leave today. I'm like a key...
You're a key ingredient to so many people's work.
Getting all this going, yeah.
You're like Christopher Lee in the Hammer Horror films. If he left, there'd be no work for everybody.
Well, do you know know that I've probably said this on our my and Howard's podcast before. But that's literally how Hammer got him to appear in lots of films that he didn't want to do.
Yeah,
it's like, I don't want to do Scars of Dracula. It's rubbish. The script's terrible.
Mm.
Well, I'm sorry, Chris, but we've already pre-sold the movie to the American market, and they're expecting it. And if you're not in it, they won't buy it. Mm. And we'll have to. You'll be putting loads of people out of work in the studio for like months. So Christopher Lee's like, oh, all right then. As long as I don't have to say anything. And they just cut all his lines out of the script.
Just hiss. He'll just hiss at them.
Yeah, essentially. Your fair enough, Chris.
I think it's probably time for us to get on with this podcast. So,
indeed.
Would you like to tell us what film we'll be looking at today?
It will be my pleasure to do that. The film for today is 1977's Orca, Killer Whale, or in some territories, Orca, the Killer Whale, or in the version that I watched for this podcast, Orca, the Killer Whale. there's many, many titles, but not to be confused with Orca, The Journey Home, starring Graham Greene, which is on Amazon Prime at the moment for free, and you could easily watch that, but it's a twee Canadian adventure film from a couple of years ago. That's not this one. This is Orca, the 1977 Jaws cash-in horror sea adventure movie.
Jaws-sploitation film.
Yes, that's a lovely coinage, Dan. I've never heard that one.
I like to call it Blackfish 2, The Revenge.
Essentially, yeah. That's the crossover, because that almost sounds like the crossover of Jaws-sploitation and Blaxploitation.
Yes, that's true.
It's a whole subgenre we've not explored, but you must find out there must be some
examples.
There must
be something there. If it was locked up, I would call it Don't Free Willy. Or Never Free Willy.
Essentially, that's like positing Orca as the underwater version of Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
Like keep him behind bars.
Just keep him locked up. But yeah, so it stars
Richard Harris, Charlotte Rampling, Will Sampson, and Keenan Wynn, and is produced by Dino De Laurentiis, directed by the great, and not so great sometimes, Michael Anderson, a British director who actually only passed away a couple of years ago.
Oh dear.
After possibly one of the longest and most illustrious careers imaginable.
What else has he directed? Because I don't think I looked up his history.
Well, to be fair, he started his career on a high and maybe never matched it again.
Okay.
But he did carry on for a long time. He started in the mid-50s with movies like The Dam Busters and the Hollywood adaptation of Around the World in 80 Days, for which he was nominated for Best Director.
Oh, yeah. So some really, really good films.
Yeah. And then he just carried on from there, and he basically, in some ways you might regard him as a hack director, because he would kind of turn his hand to almost anything. Everything was quite sincere. He did a lot of kind of sci-fi genre stuff, and in interviews he was quite always excited about the imaginative possibilities of that kind of thing. So he, you know, he would later in the 70s, not long before Orca, he did Logan's Run.
In the
80s he did Millennium with Chris Christopherson, a kind of weird time traveling.
Well, I think our jewels are bleeping in our hands. I think we're next. we're definitely past our 30s.
I am 29.
Young, virile.
In this perfect world of total pleasure, we can have everything except our 30s.
I've got six pack too, and rippling biceps and firm buttocks.
The beauty of podcasting, you know.
We've got sexy voices, and that's what makes up for it.
One of us has. Yeah, I feel I must kind of slightly apologize to you, Dan, for this in a little way. I feel like I've slightly misled you.
Oh.
Because the concept of the Secret Defenders, I believe, is people defending unloved films that they love.
Yes.
And I sort of do love Orca.
Oh, okay.
But it is not necessarily one of my favourite films or anything like that.
That's fine.
But I really wanted to talk about it on a podcast simply because I don't think anybody else ever has. I Googled this.
Yeah, trying to see if there was any podcasts around the film.
Because it's a movie that I discovered, and I'll tell you how I discovered it a bit later. But and I really wanted to talk to people about it, and I've never been able to. So in a way, this is purely for me, this.
Well, but, yes. Yeah, it is. It is.
And I'm very excited to go on about it.
So Orca is, so it's a film that's like, it's not necessarily, like you said, it's not necessarily one of your favourites, but it's one you felt deserved a bit more notice and to be made aware of.
Absolutely. There's things in it which I would recommend to anyone. There's also things that I almost can't recommend to anyone. But, you know, I suppose you've got to be aware of the whole package.
Yes, yes. It's definitely, we'll get to the cult film test later, but it's definitely a cult film in my eyes. Like, it's very unique.
I'm glad to hear that now. I mean, you watched this on my recommendation.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I'd never seen it before myself. Yeah. So when and where did you discover this?
Well, I discovered it in the place where a lot of cult films get discovered, in the middle of the night in a student house in about 2001.
Okay.
This was the kind of movie in those days, kind of disreputable, big budget movies from the 70s and 80s were still considered kind of suitable fare for a near midnight screening on BBC One. Not so much these days. Now it's all kind of mid 2000s blockbusters
that
get shunted into those slots. And I watched about 10 minutes of it and with a bunch of guys. Hmm. I lived in a house with seven guys. We just saw this scene happening and kind of went, what the hell?
Yeah.
But we were unable to watch the rest of the film. I can't remember why. About 2 years later, after uni, it was on again in the same slot, and I did watch it this time, and I was even vaguely aware of a couple of other people who maybe had watched it.
Okay.
But since then, I've not found anyone else who's seen it. And also, to my knowledge, it's not been on TV again. On terrestrial. And for this, to watch it again for this, I had to go to Amazon Prime to find it. So it is out there. Yeah, it's a movie that I've been looking for a suitable channel to both see again and talk about for a long time. And now, because of this, I can't.
So what are the reasons that you love the film? What would you say?
Well, I almost feel like it's the kind of film where we've got to describe it a bit and maybe get through the stuff that's not lovable.
Okay.
In order to then qualify the great stuff. But, well, look, I'll just say this. How can you not love a film which has, I would say, one of the greatest love songs ever written in it about a whale?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And you can break that sense up any way you want, but it is one of the greatest love songs ever written about a whale, I think. Also, it has a scene where a whale burns down a town.
Yes, that is in the film.
So,
The score is, I actually think the score is really good.
The score is amazing.
You know? Yeah.
It's this is an Italian-British-American co-production.
Mm-hmm.
The music is by the great Italian composer Ennio Morricone.
Mwah!
Absolutely. I mean, I think he was great at the time, and he's still alive and still producing stuff now. Whereas most of the other great Hollywood composers have died. Mm. John Williams is still around.
He's still going. Still going.
Does Star Wars. But I don't know if you've noticed that he's stopped scoring Steven Spielberg films.
Oh, has he?
Which suggests to me he's slowing down.
Yeah.
He's obviously decided, I'll do the Star Wars because I don't want anyone else doing that.
Yeah, thanks.
But he's in his 80s. Morricone is kind of the same age and probably has a similar level of productivity.
Yeah.
But what he did do, which Williams hasn't done recently, is a couple of years ago, he won Best Score at the Oscars for the music to Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight.
Of course, that was him.
And which is quite an achievement because most of that score was not new. It was kind of composed of offcuts from unused bits of score that Morricone had done for all the films Thing and The Exorcist 2. And in a way, Tarantino just took those bits and put them in the film and said,
can I use this?
But Morricone did write a totally original
score.
Not a totally original score, but a totally original kind of opening theme for the film and a few linking bits. And it's just great. I mean, I would watch that movie again just for the score, in a way, a bit like Hawk. I think that Morricone is probably one of the greatest composers living.
Mm.
I think, not that my knowledge of classical composers in the world is exhausted.
No, of course.
But I think the only composer I can think to challenge him at the moment is probably Philip Glass. And I think Orca is actually one of his great works. I think the score is wonderful. And I do think the love theme in it, which is all about a whale, is a beautiful.
It's two whales in love. It's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
not interspecies love, are we?
Spoilers. I mean, when I say it's one of the greatest love songs, I'm kind of half serious because I think it is a great moving tune. At the end of the film, they put lyrics on it, which don't necessarily sound amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty... Yeah.
But I kind of think maybe with slightly different words and maybe a different kind of voice, it would be. But the... can't remember the Carol Connors is the name of the woman who sings at the end of the film. I'm not sure she was the best choice.
No, I would agree. I do remember going, oh God. After the ending, I was like, you know,
yeah,
then
no,
I got,
it's
and
then
it starts
expecting.
With that. I mean, was like, oh, it's a bit jarring.
I think, again, coming kind of preempting the cult film test, things which you want from a cult film are things you don't expect.
Yeah.
For good or ill.
Yeah.
And also, I think a lot of them have Ennio Morricone on the music, you know.
Most of the time, yeah, I'd say so.
There's so much Tarantino drawn from that.
Oh, definitely.
So these are two things we're already cooking on.
Okay, let's talk about the plot. We've avoided that for as long as possible now. I think we have to talk about the plot. So
yes, and to be fair to Orca, avoiding the plot for a long time is a sin which lots of films do.
Yes.
But Orca does not get
no.
into it.
Oh, yeah.
Straight away. So basically,
go on, tell us.
Allow me to sum up. Yeah. Richard Harris plays the worst fisherman in the world.
Yes. Of Dumbledore fame.
Yes, absolutely. The great Irish film star, Richard Harris. He's an Irish fisherman living in Newfoundland because he's inherited a fishing boat from his Canadian uncle, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that was something like that.
And he's a grizzled, but none too bright, fisherman who hunts sharks for a living, then realises that orcas, killer whales, are larger and more profitable. You could argue that all of this is total nonsense.
Yeah.
But anyway, he suddenly realises that the killer whales are great and he wants to hunt one and sell it to an aquarium. In hunting one, he's not very good. He accidentally kills it. And he kills a female orca and her child, an unborn child, in an astonishing sequence. Its mate, the male orca, sees him do this and begins an undeclared war of revenge against Richard Harris's character. And basically, the rest of the film is a series of confrontations, both at sea and not at sea.
On the land, yeah.
Yeah, with a killer whale.
Strangely.
Full of absolutely
amazing... It's pretty bonkers.
...bits of dialogue, like Richard Harris shouting, "I'll fight you, you are a vengeful son of a bitch!"
That is a line.
And during the course of this development, he gets attached to a oceanographer played by Charlotte Rampling.
Yes, fantastic.
And a Native American teacher, guy, sailor, by Will Sampson.
Where are they? They're in Canada, aren't they?
Newfoundland. Off Canada,
right? Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I am immediately drawn to the film, is that I think it's a really interesting setting.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I think, you know, I love monster movies. I love ghost stories and things like that.
Hmm.
A lot of sea adventures, obviously, have kind of coastal settings, but also a lot of ghost stories.
Yeah,
you know,
The fog.
Yeah, and like, you know, and the woman in black, and you've got... I just find those kind of towns interesting because they're kind of liminal. They're on the border with another kind of environment.
Yeah.
They are
fringe environment.
Yeah. They are a natural setting for stories in which the usual rules of life start not to apply. And I always find those interesting. And when I go to kind of coastal towns, I feel a bit of the strange atmosphere.
You're the outsider, and there's other rules. I mean, with seaside towns, with the sea, there's obviously a lot of like superstition, and that plays heavily in this movie as well. There's a lot of kind of the fish. Harris.
Yeah, I mean, let's also admit there are lots of stereotypes about seaside.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah,
And about them being superstitious and stuff. I'm not saying that stereotypes are necessarily true. I do think it's an interesting realm to think about and speak stories in.
Oh, of course.
And the movie, definitely. The movie, by the way, is written by Italian, and I think it may play into some stereotypes about maybe Native Americans, fishing communities, Canada, that those writers were not too distinctive about.
Yeah, of course not. They weren't like.
Having said that, I suppose I should say that having done a quick Google about this film, it is apparently based on a book by an American writer called Arthur Herzog, who's another book of
his. No relation to Werner.
No relation to Werner Herzog. no, I'm not going to do it because I'll just turn into a horrible cliche. But Werner Herzog has one of the best voices ever, and you can do it. That's a wonderful song. But no, I don't think so. Or indeed related to a director I worked with once called Andreas Herzog. Good name. But no, he was like a creature disaster novelist guy. Okay. He also wrote a book called The Swarm, which was made into a film with Michael Caine.
Oh, I've heard of this. I've heard of this.
I've never seen it, and it's a famous disaster.
Yeah.
So in a way, I'd love to see it. There's a great kind of one-man show that I saw Michael Caine doing where he described the moment where he was asked to be in the swarm and he gets a phone call and his voice goes, "Hey, it's hey Michael, how are you doing? It's Erwin Allen." And Michael Caine thinks to himself, "What? It's Erwin Allen. He produced The Towering Inferno and The Poseidon Adventure. He's a genius."
Yeah.
I'm so pleased to hear his voice.
Known as the Master of Disaster, I believe.
Indeed. And Erwin Allen says, "I got a movie for you." And Michael Caine says, "I'm so excited to be doing a movie for Erwin Allen." So I said, "I'll do anything, Erwin." He says, "It's about some killer bees." I said, "That's okay." anyway, massive tangent. But although in a way that does paint the kind of situation that cinema in the 70s, in the late 70s, was kind of in the wake of the success of Jaws, which was in 75, people wanted monster movies. Yeah. There'd always been monster movies, but they wanted the new wave, the big creature.
The new style.
Yeah, you know, they want, and there's a certain amount of throwing back to the monster movies of the 50s and doing them again.
Yeah, yeah.
And
with repackaging.
And I do think it's important to say, I kind of think, as a film fan, I point of view that the 70s are probably the greatest period of Hollywood. Or maybe kind of Western cinema.
I think Western creativity in general, I think the 70s was a very good period, historically, just for creation of music, comic books, movies, you name it. Speaking of comic books, The Swarm has reminded me of one of my favourite comic book characters. It's a Spider-Man villain.
Oh, right.
Or a Champions villain, and he's called The Swarm. And he happens to be a Nazi scientist whose body is comprised entirely of mutant killer bees.
Okay. Right.
And that sounds like a movie in itself.
I think maybe he had an influence on Clive Barker.
Possibly. Who knows? Oh, with the candy.
Yeah. I think Hollywood was at its best in the 70s, and I think the reason for that is, or at least the reason it seems best from where I am, my vantage point, is that in the 70s, many of the creators and stars of the kind of golden Hollywood period were still there. And at the same time, people who would become stars and who are stars now and who are massively influential now were starting to arrive. So you could have a movie with, say, James Stewart and Al Pacino. I don't think there is one.
No.
But, you know, but on the
other hand, that's a fan fiction for you, isn't it?
You had the disaster movies boom, and you did have, like, for instance, one that I love. I should talk about this on another episode.
Yeah, sure.
Is Airport 77.
Okay.
Which has James Stewart, but also has Christopher Lee, but also has Jack Lemmon, you know, but also has, like, Gil Gerard, who was Buck Rogers in the 70s TV series.
Wow.
And just a weird multi-general.
Yeah.
Brenda Vaccaro from, I think, Supergirl is in it. So Orca kind of comes at that moment. The other thing that happened in the 70s with Hollywood is that, you know, the old studio system was giving way to the new wave of filmmakers. So you had, like, Coppola, who starts in the 60s, and then really changed things with The Godfather, and people like Spielberg and George Lucas, who were kind of his proteges. And in a way, Spielberg and Lucas, by doing Jaws and Star Wars, reinvented the big studio movie, made it into and created the summer blockbuster that we know today. Your listeners know all this, I'm sure. Everyone knows this. I'm saying nothing new. But the point is that I think Dino De Laurentiis, who was a very storied Italian producer, who in the late 70s was just moving over to Hollywood and trying to get kind of Hollywood scale productions going after having done loads of things for decades in Italy. And he takes a look around at what's big in Hollywood, what's really happening, and kind of goes, "Right, I can do better than that."
Yeah.
But the way that he says that is connected not to the reality of what's going on in Hollywood at the time, but to his conception of what was great about old Hollywood, which is probably the kind of cinema that inspired him when he was becoming a film producer in the 50s and things like that. So therefore, you've got a big, feel-good, amazing monster movie blockbuster like Jaws, which, you know, is one of my absolute favourite films. In a way, Orca is here in place of Jaws, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, because you thought it needed more of a spotlight. Jaws doesn't need a spot.
Yeah, Yeah.
Everyone knows Jaws.
Yeah, and there's a connection between them, obviously. So De Laurentiis sees that and goes, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do it bigger and better. The first thing he tries to do to outdo Jaws is he remakes King Kong in 76.
He does, yes.
That was specifically because he saw Jaws and said, what can we do? And basically he decided, look, they made a big mechanical shark. There's no reason why we can't make a big mechanical ape. And they did. And it didn't work.
And well, Jaws did work.
Well, no, it didn't work either. the whole reason that Jaws is wonderful is that you don't see the monster for so much because they couldn't film it, because it wasn't working. That part of the story had obviously not got to Dino.
Yeah.
And they built a big King Kong that didn't work and couldn't be filmed. It's hardly in the film. Most of that movie is a man in a suit.
Yeah.
The illustrious Rick Baker in a monkey suit. But he did that and he brought it out anyway. And he'd already, even before King Kong came out, he's like, right, Jaws, we're going to really hit this one. I need an even bigger fish. And he literally says to his producer, Luciano Vincenzoni, find me a bigger fish that's like scarier than Jaws.
To fry.
Do this. Essentially, yeah. I got bigger fish to fry. yeah, he said that in Italian. But yeah, so they look into that. But the way that De Laurentiis wants to outdo Jaws, which is the new way of doing movies, by a new young director who is like 25 or something, and which is making people happy and having them leave the cinema feeling good in a way that they almost can't remember ever having done. It creates popcorn cinema, it creates summer cinema.
Yeah.
And what does Dino do? He goes, we're going to make a killer whale movie. So we're going to base it on Moby Dick. We're going to get the director of... We're going to get a director who's nearly won an Oscar, right? Mm. We're going to get an even bigger director than Spielberg. So bloody Michael Anderson, who 20 years beyond his Oscar nomination at this point. Yeah, he's really good. But I just think it speaks to the fact that De Laurentiis is looking entirely in the wrong place. And also, like, it's like, I think the main character in Orca is the grizzled fisherman, played by Richard Harris, who's great in it.
He's really good. It's a really strong performance.
And if you close your eyes, I think you can picture him playing Quint in Jaws.
Yeah, easily.
And be just as good.
Yeah.
Robert Shaw in that film is wonderful. This guy would be just as good.
Yeah.
But, like, newsflash, Dino, Quint was not the hero of Jaws.
No.
Quint is the grizzled fisherman who kind of comes in to take over the film towards the end.
Morally blurry.
And he's like, he's not very likable. No. And you're always on the side of the young cop and the young oceanographer played by Richard Dreyfuss. Those characters have no analog in Orca. It's all about Quint, essentially. Yeah. This is what. And by the way, Quint's boat in Jaws is called the Orca. And they deliberately named that because they wanted it to be something that could kill a shark.
Well, that's literally how the film opens. They're fishing, hunting for sharks. They're trying to get a shark. And then the Charlotte Rampling's an oceanographer and her team are investigating something.
Yeah.
And then they see a shark is nearby. They're trying to hide under some rubble, just under the water.
Yeah, Charlotte tries to get away from the shark. By the way, that shark looks really frighteningly close to Charlotte Rampling. And I think that footage is quite alarming. I mean, it's not her.
Yeah.
I'm sure it isn't her. The underwater footage of the real sharks was actually filmed in Australia by Ron Taylor, the guy who also with his wife Valerie filmed the real shark footage for Jaws, also in Australia. So you know, you've got some stuff with the real shark going on. You've then got Charlotte Rampling gets out of the water and goes into the boat,
and
her colleague falls in the water in like the most stupid way.
He just kind of goes whoa. Yeah. Very comically, just like, I'm falling out of my dinghy.
And the shark goes after him, but at the last minute it is intercepted very dramatically.
Like a missile. I think the shark is actually knocked out of the water. Yeah. And everyone's like, what did that? And it's like, that's an orca. Title.
Well, it's trailer moment.
Yeah, pretty much.
Richard Harris goes, my God, what did that?
And
Charlotte Rampling goes, there's only one creature in the world that could do that, a killer whale.
Boom.
And she says that with all the dramatic power of someone who really hates where they are in life at this moment.
I think Charlotte Rampling always looks like she hates what she's doing constantly. But she is a little bit, like, I'll be honest, I'm quite attracted to Charlotte Rampling. Oh,
no, she's very attractive.
Like, she's very talented. I watched her recently I watched The Night Porter.
Right, which was made before this.
Yes.
In the 70s, she was a major sex symbol.
Huge.
Because of The Night Porter, which was a very sexually frank Italian movie.
Very.
The Bogart.
Yeah.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
I also watched Zardoz. She was in Zardoz.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen that. And she's in...
It's weird.
She gets credit with me because she contributed to the British horror.
Of course, yeah.
She's in Asylum, which is an Amicus film from 70s.
Oh, I need to watch that.
Very good. I like it. But I think in this film, she definitely looks like she just doesn't want to be that.
Right.
And I don't blame her, because...
Not got a whole lot to do, I'll be honest.
And well, mainly she's delivering exposition.
Which is
written in kind of terrible, not quite correctly translated English, which is what you obviously... I think that everyone in the film speaks in this strange way, which is what happens when writers write in not their first language.
Yeah.
The only one that this does not apply to is Nolan, Richard Harris's character.
Yeah.
I think he had a deal with the director. Basically said, look, this character's supposed to be Irish, let me Irish it up. And the director... by the way, Michael Anderson could speak Italian. So because Dino De Laurentiis always kind of used it as a kind of shield that he couldn't speak English, probably.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of the crew could not speak English. But Anderson, he spoke about 3 or 4 languages. He's certainly in his element. And he could go up to the producers and go, look, Richard Harris wants to do this with the script. I think he should. And get that leeway. Which is why when Charlotte Rampling's colleague falls in the water for no reason.
Yeah.
Richard Harris shouts, "That Egypt's falling in the water!"
That's one of my favourite lines in the whole film.
Yeah, it's just wonderful.
He's like, "What are they doing with that shark about? What are they doing down there?" I was just like, he's not wrong, but yeah.
No, it's like, I mean, it's funny, it makes me laugh, but I think it's great that he did that.
Yeah.
I think that... Everything that Nolan kind of
said. He created a real character with that. Like, nobody else has the amount of development that the Richard Harris character has. No. Even Charlotte Rampling doesn't have much to say or do other than... Well, she kind of changes her mind every 5 minutes what she wants him to do. She's like, you're a coward for not fighting him, but I didn't like when you killed the other whale, but you should kill this one because of the fisherman town and they hate you and they're going to, they want you. It's, the motivation of her is kind of all over the show.
And then later in the film, when he's going to go kill it, she goes, no, you shouldn't kill it.
Yeah. It's like, oh, face him. You have to fight him on his own terms. Because she talks, like you said, she talks at the start. To be fair, like the exposition that she's giving is she's teaching a class. And I think that's probably...
Well, that's like an extremely rote...
Yeah.
...approach to solve the problem. How do we get this exposition into the film? Oh, yeah, we'll have her doing a lecture. Now, that is justified because according to the script... Nolan comes to the lectures and listens to her speaking and then starts to meet with her afterwards and they become friends. But you don't see any of this in the film. This is all given in a voiceover.
Yeah.
Which I think is like they were going to film that, but they couldn't get Richard Harris to be at the location or whatever.
I think it could have done with a few extra minutes added on because it seems very...
It's very tight.
Yeah, it's very, very tight.
B-movie.
Yeah.
So you've got this scene where it's basically just there to give exposition. And to be fair, I think it's quite effective. It doesn't connect dramatically to anything else in the film. But Charlotte Rampling, even on total autopilot, is able to deliver these lines with a great deal of kind of portent, where she says, you know, it is without challenge the most powerful creature on the earth, and things like that.
And
she does
Orcinus, the bringer of death.
Well, yeah, which is not called, by the way.
No, no.
It's called Orcinus Orca, is the correct Latin.
Yeah.
And I think Bringer of Death is a kind of slightly broad translation.
Yeah.
Also, there's a bit where she...
I think we're talking about a lot of broad translations in regards to the Italian from the script.
Quite possibly. there's also a bit, I don't know if you noticed, where she demonstrates to the class the size of the orca's brain.
I do remember, yeah.
She puts up a chart with 4 brains, but she says... Now, these 3 brains are a dog, an ape, and a killer whale.
There's four of us, yeah.
And it's like, no one thought to change that when they were editing it. Or you know, she's not even on camera.
She could,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's not because it wouldn't match her lips.
No. I don't think I realised at the time, but then it took me a minute, and I was like, but there was 4 pictures.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever. Move it on.
It's just like she just got bored and she missed one of
I'll just forget one of my lines to hurry it along.
I want to say something now that I should have said right at the start.
No worries.
There's a book that I wanted to bring today called Great Lies to Tell Small Kids by the British comedy writer Andy Reilly.
Okay.
I believe you've got some examples of the lies contained in this book.
I do. Would you like me to cherry pick any? Or
give us a couple.
Wine makes mummy clever.
Nice.
It takes the brakes of seven penguins to make a penguin biscuit.
Okay.
Don't know about that one.
That's a totally mental one. Can we have one more?
Yes. Milk feels pain. So this sounds like an interesting book.
It is a fun book. I was given to me for Christmas a few years ago, and basically it's suggestions for a form of sanctioned child abuse. I would suggest, if you're going to do that, then a great lie that you could add to the list is Orca is an absolutely classic mythic film of Western culture. And Jaws was a shoddy ripoff that was made a couple of years later. I would love to bring someone in that knowledge and say how old they got before they worked out the truth. And also what it would lead you to believe. Because in a way, I think that I'm going to argue that there's a lot of quality stuff in Orca. It's not the movie that Jaws is.
No.
But it does, I think.
I'd argue it's a bit closer, like you said, to Moby Dick.
Well, I think that De Laurentiis kind of grasped that there was something mythic about the story that Jaws told.
Mm.
So he wanted to do something that was even more mythic, more on the nose with that.
Classic.
And I do think it has that sense of a mythic, epic struggle that maybe even Jaws doesn't quite manage.
Yeah.
Because Jaws is absolutely brilliant, but at the end of the day, it is just a B-movie.
Yeah.
Whereas Orca, which is a B movie, but it struggles for this kind of epic,
this kind of
story of a man's folly.
There's even kind of a mystical, mythical element to it with the Native American character, the fisherman's kind of, they're talking about, I mean, like we talked about those first two scenes in the opening of the film, it's basically going, forget Jaws. This is the killer. This is so much better than, it's just like, we just knocked Jaws out of the, we've literally knocked Jaws out of the water via the killer whale. And, you know, and then we're describing how intelligent it is, how it bonds for life, how they're vengeful. They've got a big brain and vengeful, which I didn't really buy, but.
No, it's weird that in her lecture, Sheldon Rappling character kind of says the kind of three things she uses to illustrate how great killer whales are is they're great parents, they bond for life, and they have a profound sense of vengeance.
Yes.
That's not our defining quality as a species, you know, and I don't think it could be the defining quality of the whales or anyone else either.
No.
Really, no, but.
So after that scene, let's carry on. So go back to your point, sorry.
But the other thing I just want to mention about the mythic quality.
Yes, sorry, yeah.
Is that it reminds me of the story of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner by you know, because it's that the whole thing of like, oh, he wants to kill the albatross and everybody tells him but he does anyway. But then the ship is cursed and he gradually comes to realise his folly. Basically, Nolan is a massive idiot.
Yeah.
And even his own crew, they don't actually tell him not to do it.
No.
But Bo Derek says...
Oh yeah, Bo Derek's in it.
You know,
yeah,
we
forgot.
Could be breaking up a family by doing this. And he just goes, ha ha ha. You know, he obviously thinks that
Calif.
Any kind of... Well, he doesn't believe in that. He just thinks it's nonsense. Everything Charlotte Rampling says to him, he kind of takes with a cheeky wink and a kind Irish smile.
Well, he talks to... In the voiceover, she says that he talks to me and asks me for all this information, and it's clearly just so he can kill the thing.
Yes, and she doesn't work that out. So what kind of scientist is she?
Yeah, exactly.
She actually says, I should have realised that fishermen don't ask about anything unless they want to hunt it or catch it or kill it.
Yes.
It's like, you should have realised that quite quickly, really, especially
being a scientist.
And also how you met him. What was he doing when you met him? He was
killing
a shark.
Yes.
But I do think that the story of Nolan, you like him even though he is an idiot.
He is
likeable. Don't think he's right, but you're kind of with him.
What I do like about his character is that, yes, he does, basically, he does hunt down the killer whale. He kills the female. He basically butchers the female, doesn't even kill her quickly, brings her on board the boat. Then something happens that I don't think I will ever see replicated in any other films ever in my life. The female whale, the stress of the butchery causes a miscarriage.
That we saw at university. Yeah. And we all went, what?
What is happening? And it's kind of this, it was kind of very darkly humorous because it's like, it just shoots out and it's this basically polystyrene square blob.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the most convincing prop head, though.
No.
And to be fair, you might not even recognise that it's a baby whale. Unless you, if you haven't seen the lecture scene at the start of the film, but at the same time, the sound it makes is awful.
Oh God, the screaming is horrible. Yeah.
And the Nolan is so disgusted that he hose pipes it off the boat.
Yeah.
Immediately.
So sensitive.
And
get it off my boat.
And the thing is, and he wasn't even trying to kill the mother whale.
No,
he was trying to capture the male.
Yeah.
And he hits the wrong whale.
It goes through the male's fin, doesn't it? It goes through the male's fin.
Which is a great bit of visual storytelling, because then you know when it's that whale, because you can see the nick on its fin.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he hits the wrong whale, and then he hauls it out of the sea in such a ham-fisted way that he almost kills it, but he certainly calls it to miscarry.
Yes.
It doesn't die for a long time.
No.
They try and take it into port or whatever.
Yeah.
But the reason why they eventually drop it into the sea again is only because the male
is battering the boat. Yeah.
And they realise that they're not going to get anywhere unless they get rid of the female whale, which is not dead at this point. Although, to be fair,
she's pretty much, yeah.
Well, I mean, it doesn't look very alive.
No, it doesn't.
But I suppose we should mention, like, because we mentioned the shark effects in Jaws, we should mention the quality of the fish effects in this, rather the mammal effects.
Mm.
I think they're quite good.
Yeah,
for that,
there was the bit when the dead female is beached. I think that whale looks awful.
Yes,
it looks terrible.
In a sense, you know,
it just doesn't look real.
Oh, right.
I think the one where it's beached, and they're like, "You did butcher it. Look what you've done. Look what you've done." You know, and it's just there. He's like, you know, he's very remorseful about it. But I thought that particular whale looks not so great. But I think the fins look well. They're good. I think the mouth, I kind of remember it. It's been about a week or so now, maybe 2 weeks. So yeah, the mouth kind of munching. I think that's pretty good. The bit where he brings a house down, doesn't he? He brings a house crashing into the water and stuff. And eats Bo Derek's leg off.
We should say spoilers, by the way.
Yeah, sorry, spoiler. We're covering spoilers now. Yeah, we've danced around it for quite some time, but yeah, these are all spoilers.
Yeah.
And they also the scene I loved is when he causes the fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the oil, it causes like this oil spill.
And somehow the whale demonstrates a knowledge of combustion and chemicals and knows exactly what to do to cause the power station on the village to explode and loads of houses burn down and stuff. Where's that come from? I don't know. But at the same time, at this point, the movie has moved into a kind of weird mystical realm.
Yeah.
Especially with the character of Omelette turning up, who's kind of the Native American guy who looks on it as a kind of sea spirit.
Yeah.
And by the time the town burns down, you know, you're an hour into the film, you already know if you hate it or not. I think probably there's been plenty of stuff that will have made you turn off before that point.
Probably.
If you can make it to the town burning down, you're probably going to go with it. And then
till the end.
That leads directly into Nolan, obviously, so that's right, I've got to go.
This is what I quite like about his character. I know that, like, in Jaws, the cop, there's the oceanographer, there's the fisherman, and they're not actively, well, they are actively going after it, but it's not out of, you know, out of greed or any negative feelings, initially. And then what he does is he made a huge mistake, and he goes, you know what, not going to do it anymore. Fair enough, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go near a whale, I'm not going to do it. But everyone's, like, pressuring him to killing the whale. He's like, you've got to kill the whale. He's like, no, I've been violent, I've learned my lesson, I'm not going to do it. And I respect that in him, that he's made the mistake, and he's going, no, I'm going to change, I'm going to be better. And the whale is basically keeps egging him on by killing these people, damaging boats, doing, you know, setting fires, you name it. It kind of really does eventually force him to the final confrontation with Orca.
And what I've just realised as you've been speaking is that the major difference between Jaws and Orca narratively is that in Jaws, from the very start, Chief Brody is like, we need to go out and kill this fish.
Yeah.
And other things, the mayor and whatever, stopping him doing that until crisis point, which doesn't happen until an hour into the film. Then they go. In this film, he doesn't want to go and haunt it, and other people are trying to get him to haunt it.
Yeah.
And it takes to crisis point for him to go, all right, we'll go.
Yeah.
And then he goes. And I think that sequence where the boat pulls out the harbour and all the fishermen
are just watching,
you know, again, you know, coastal stereotypes and whatever. It's a very kind of
eerie
moment. And really backed up by the score. So many of these kind of aesthetic elements are really nice. The other thing I'd kind of say about Orca, again, kind of which compares favourably to a lot of movies made now, is that, it's daft and it's sometimes distasteful and sometimes stupid, but the basic story makes sense.
Yeah.
The conflict between the Orca, the whale,
and the man...
makes sense that how they both act.
Yeah.
Some of the other characters and some of the other incidents are pretty unbelievable, but the basic, there's a storyline there that's really simple and really works.
Yeah.
I don't know what, you know, the human characters in the fishing village are not necessarily a representation of those kind of people.
No.
The Charlotte Rumbling character doesn't make any sense.
No.
She
says you've got to challenge him, you've got to do it. And then he makes a scarecrow of himself to stand at the end of the pier.
Yeah.
So he's like, he's just there watching. And he's like, I'm just going to go shoot him. And she's like, no, you can't shoot him. I'm just like, make your mind up. What do you want? Give him, I really did identify with the lead character, with Richard Harris's performance.
Yeah.
Because nobody else is making any sense. The whale's not making sense. Like, nothing makes sense. And he's like, I tried to make some money. I tried to do it carefully. I fucked up. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone's like, no, you got to do it. But don't do it like that. Do it like this.
And he's been given bad advice by everyone. And eventually he's just got to do something.
And he goes, right, I'm going off to the Arctic is where the final confrontation takes place.
Yeah, it is the Arctic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Filmed in Italy, by the way.
Yeah, the icebergs don't look that convincing.
No, they built the icebergs in Italy. But I still think it's a pretty decent place for an epic conclusion.
Yeah, it was pretty epic.
I mean...
What does he say? He says, the ice... The ice cuts both ways.
Yes, it's a bit like Star Trek 2, kind of going into the nebula. All our senses will be ruined.
Yeah.
You know, the odds will be even.
Yeah.
I should say as well, I think that most of this movie looks beautiful.
Mm.
It's actually shot by Ted Moore, who did most... He's cinematography... God, I don't want to say. He was cinematographer on most of the early James Bond films, not all of them. And I think possibly the reason he was chosen for this is because one of the ones he did do was Thunderball, which is the underwater.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Which is one of the first movies to make major use of underwater photography.
Yeah.
The underwater director, or the director of the underwater sequences in this film, was an Italian with the amazing name Falco Quilici. And I think he did a wonderful job as well. I do think it's that they kind of embrace a convention, which maybe you kind of have to when you're shooting underwater, which is that all of the underwater sequences are shot in daylight.
Yeah.
Even when the above water scene is at night.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously you've got to have light coming from somewhere.
Exactly.
Otherwise you can't see anything.
Yeah. And especially if it's like killer whales are predominantly black as well. So you need something.
Yeah. But I think most of it kind of works. I also think there's I've kind of made fun of Michael Anderson a little bit, and I do think he was a bizarre kind of choice. You know, we need a new Spielberg. Who can we get? Michael Anderson. But there's great visual storytelling in the movie. I mean, the opening sequence, there's a long time before anybody says it. You've got a lovely title sequence.
And I wanted to mention this,
Go on, you say.
Well, it's with the love theme you were discussing earlier. It's playing, and it's this kind of, I think it's a sunset or it's a sunrise.
Yeah.
And it's two whales kind of lovely, kind of joyous kind of dance.
There's a thing that whales do called breaching, where they leap out of the water.
That's it,
And basically, they're doing that as a quick kind of courtship.
Really. Yeah, and that's kind of the whole theme plays. I think almost the whole theme, at least, plays. And it is this beautiful, and it's like, you know, this is nature, this is beauty, this is, you know, this is a gorgeous animal, and it, you know, it cares, it's sensitive, it has an incredible brain, you know, all these sort of things. It's deeply in love, bonds for life, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah, you're actually invited to care about the monster.
Exactly, yeah.
Which you are certainly not in your...
No.
And a lot.
Oh, exactly.
I think maybe this is a hangover from King Kong remake, because
identifying with the monster.
Yeah, I think there's a famous interview with Dino De Laurentiis where he was on British or American TV, and they obviously kept being this for a while, but they asked him in English, is this King Kong film better than Jaws? And he goes, yes! And they said, why? And he said, because when Jaws die, nobody cry. When King Kong die, everybody cry. And I thought that's all Italian.
I'm a bit Italian. I find that offensive. I'll forgive you on behalf of all Italian people.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I feel better already. So I think there's a bit of that following over. But also, leading up to that sequence, the title sequence, where you've got a little kind of gentle sliver of the score building up, but also the visual is two dots going together. And you hear the kind of whale song.
Yes.
And it took me a couple of viewings to work out what it was, but basically that's the meeting of the two whales. It's like, so they've been trapped on the sonar.
Yeah.
And they've obviously been speaking to each other over a huge distance, and they've swam together. And then when the credits end and you have the fade up on the sunrise, they leap out of the water, that's their meeting.
Yeah.
And then immediately following the whole kind of romantic breaching with two whales, you go to Newfoundland, and there's a banner across and you can hear the whale sounds. Yeah. Then the camera pans down and you realise the whale sounds are coming from a tape recorder. Then you follow the kind of microphone lead, whatever, from the tape recorder, which goes down into the sea.
Yeah.
Then you go into the sea and you follow that down and you find the diver who's kind of placing it. Mm. That's the introduction to Charlotte Rampling's character. And it's the way that so much of the plot and the location and the character of the movie have been set up in that whole sequence without any words.
And it's quite seamless as well. And like you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Dan. I totally agree with that.
Thank you, Dan.
And In all honesty, I enjoyed this. I don't think it's a bad film. Again, it's not a great film, I don't think, but I enjoyed watching it. I think the main reason I kept watching was Richard Harris. I think I don't say carries the film, but it's, you're invested in him. And I like,
he's a charismatic presence.
He is very charismatic. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of bit characters that are kind of there for reasons, but don't necessarily have to be. But I do like the quest. I like the mythic angle. I like the reluctance on his part of killing the whale. I like the ridiculous kind of disaster movie elements to it that don't really make sense, you know. I enjoyed it. It was a very much, like you said, a popcorn box office summer film. It's, you know, it's escapism, you know, it's just turn your mind off for a couple of hours. And again, it's a really simple premise. You know, I could watch that in a different language and still get what's going on. You don't need to know all the plot. You don't need to know that it's no, you know, bringer of death and all this exposition. I don't need to know all that. Yeah. I can see what's happened. It's all, I think that's a sign of a good film, is when you can still get genuinely the plot. I watched, what did I watch the other day? The Accountant with Ben Affleck. It's an action movie, but it's got so much going on. And there's a strange obsession with the accounting, which is so dull. I'm not recommending it. Don't watch it. I found it was boring. There was so many plot elements going on. There's romance, brothers, past, autism, you know, being a badass soldier, all this kind of interwoven plot. But like something like this is, I prefer this. So it's like straight to the point. Like you said, that setup tells us all we need to know, basically. And then the opening scene says, bam, this is going to be better than Jaws. Then we get the kind of the exposition and some kind of Charlotte Rampling voiceover every now and again, which I don't think was necessarily needed.
Well, no, because that was a question I wanted to ask you, Dan. So, I mean, I think you've already answered it, to be honest, but who's the viewpoint character of this movie? I think it's...
You could argue it's the whale. You could argue.
Well, you could argue... Well, you know where the whale's coming.
Yeah.
And you know roughly where Nolan's coming from. So it's mainly like, I did something stupid.
Yeah.
I want to do it. I want to make it right. I don't know how...
To make it right, yeah.
But at least that, you know, you can identify with that. The voiceover should be from one of those characters if you have a voiceover. Instead, it's from Charlotte Rampling, and I'm sure that it's only there because there were some scenes they couldn't film.
Yeah.
I mean, later in the film, there are moments where the voiceover does come back.
Yeah, it's very infrequent.
Yeah.
The voiceover's not as, it should be more free. It should be more of a kind of a guiding thing throughout the film. It's like, every now and again, it's just like, we headed towards Alaska to face the whale for the final time.
Yeah, which the audience knows.
Yeah, they've just said, we're going to Alaska. But I did quite enjoy the final sequence, the battle on the ice and stuff. I know it's relatively short, but I like you said, it was an epic kind of end to it.
It has a doomly sense to it, I think. Mm. Just invented a new word, doomly.
Doomly.
You know, they could fight on any patch of walls
yeah,
in any exactly. weather. But the sense of isolation to it, and the fact that, you know, not only the whale, but the elements are against yeah. them. They're going to get frozen into the ice. Yeah. Some of the icebergs kind of crumbling and things like that. You know, and obviously, we've gone into spoiler territory.
Yeah, yeah,
and the crew die one by one in yes. different ways. And there is just this sense of it's... And ultimately, Nolan
yeah,
dies.
He does.
That's the... I think the story is the whale... There's a beautiful... Are we allowed to talk about the ending?
Yeah, do it.
There's a beautiful futility about the fact that the whale gets its revenge. And then at the cost of... And for what? You know, and then there's that lovely kind of... Well, I'm not sure it's lovely, really. It's kind of a little bit... It's really a collision of some unconvincing optical work.
Yeah.
Basically, that after Nolan has died, the whale is kind of trapped under the ice. And I read it when I first saw it. The implication is that it's one, it's alive, but it needs to breathe and it
yeah,
can't get to the surface.
Because of that, yeah.
So it's going to die down there.
Yeah.
And that's probably all it wants to do because it's lost the love of its life.
Well, I mean, there's... In real life, like when an old couple is one of them dies, the other one tends to die of a broken heart, don't they? So
yeah.
they pass not long after because they've got no kind of will to live, sadly, or, you know, for whatever. Well, but I think with the whale, it was almost like he'd had his revenge. That was the only thing he was living for.
Yeah.
So now it passed as well. But I like what you were saying about the ice and the kind of the futility of it. I think it also, you know, it screams to me that vengeance is a dish best served cold. You know, you know, we're heading that, and it's cold vengeance. Their hearts have frozen over. Like, they both lost their loved ones. They've got nothing. Like, they lost their Richard Harris's character. I can't remember the character's name. What's his name?
Nolan.
That was it. Sorry.
I don't know what his first name is.
Yeah, Nolan is, yeah. It's Captain Nolan, we'll call him.
Yeah.
But he's kind of like, he reveals that he lost his family due to a drunk driver.
Yeah.
Collision. So he's
that's a kind of clunkily inserted plot element.
Yeah.
The way that they do that. But yeah, but he does play into the theme.
Yeah. And I mean, I think he's likable enough without that, but yeah. I think they wanted to just hammer home the similarity between the two, the whale and Nolan, and how they both, you know, got nothing to live for. This is it. It's all we're living for now. And he's taken all his friends, everything he knew, the boat, his life, you know, his life there. He wanted to go. He didn't even want to live there, did he? He wanted to get some money and move out. And he was going to, got the whale, he was going to make the money from that, and he was going
to
leave.
He just wants to be able to sell the boat, basically, doesn't he?
Like, yeah, it's just like, get rid of it.
And I think that the progression that he makes during the story is that basically he's just a guy, he's a good guy, but he just doesn't have a great deal of empathy. He realises that the whale has feelings and that in a way he's subjecting it to the same horror that he's gone through in losing his wife and his child.
Mm.
But he doesn't realise that until way into having done it. You know, He can't conceive of that, which is it actually kind of makes sense when Bo Derek's character basically says to him, "Look, you can't do this."
Yeah,
and he just kind of smirks.
Yeah,
he just can't kind of read
it's
that
just
idea.
That, the arrogance of man, isn't it? And that kind of like, we're the dominant species on the planet. We're the most intelligent. Everything else is just game. And that's it. I do really like the scene where he goes into he's mutilated the female. You know, everything's happened, and he goes in. He asks the priest. He was like, "Can you commit a sin against an animal?" And he goes, "Well, I think it's you committing a sin against yourself."
Yeah.
It's like, that's what you've got to balance that sin against, not against, you know, an animal you can't necessarily relate to. It's something that's why you're asking, because it's what makes you feel. It's not what the animal feels, even though the animal clearly does feel revenge very strongly.
He's a revengeful son of a bitch.
Revengeful son of a fish, son of a mammal. It's not a fish, he's a mammal, but yeah. I've got a very embarrassing childhood something I misconstrued about killer whales.
Okay.
So you know that the killer whales have those kind of the white panels on the sides of their faces?
Yeah, yeah.
When I was and their actual eyes are quite dark.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't tell they're even there. There are some nice shots, I will say, there are some nice shots of the whale's eye in this.
Yeah, especially when they kind of do the optical effect where you see him reflected in the eye.
Yeah.
So they kind of reverse that later on, and then be his eye reflecting the whale.
That's right, yeah. Some nice kind of mirroring there. But I actually believe that the white portion of the killer whale's head was actually their eyes.
Right.
I think when I was a kid, obviously, I read a lot of comics, so there's like characters like Venom who have these big, big white eyes, and you're like, those work, those are normal. Those are totally normal. Killer whales have that. But then again, because it was like when I watched Free Willy as a kid, it was like those eyes were so dark you couldn't even tell they were necessarily eyes.
Mm.
And again, you didn't get necessarily necessarily a really strong close-up. I was like, I think what I thought they were, the like side blowholes or something.
Right.
Like blowholes either side of the head. These are not, you know. Richard Attenborough probably is like cursing me for thinking such a stupid thing.
What both need to do now is go and watch a Richard Attenborough, David Attenborough.
David. Oh, sorry, I said Richard Attenborough, didn't I? Yeah.
David Attenborough's kind of Life on Earth.
But I mean, I would rather watch Richard Attenborough in Jurassic Park.
Well, wouldn't anyone, you know?
Maybe based it off himself. So I think we've covered it. Is there anything else you want to say?
There's a few other things in my notes that I just want to.
Yeah, of course.
You just mentioned the church scene when they're talking about sin, and you know, again, no one is going to stereotypes, but I think the Italian screenwriters may have been Roman Catholic.
Possibly,
And they probably know things about this. Or on the other hand, it's just a cliche that you go into, which is where you have like the wise, the priest.
Yeah.
But also, there's just a really good example of the Italian translated into English dialogue that everybody except Nolan speaks. At the end of that scene, the priest says to, when he says that line that you just mentioned, he says, "A sin is really against yourself. You understand?"
Yeah.
Nolan just goes, "Yeah." And then the very next scene, there's the introduction of the character I quite like called Al Swain, who's like the superintendent of the port.
Okay.
You know, he's the head. He's
The guy with the beard. The guy with the beard,
played by an actor called Scott Walker. And he says something like, "You're not hunting a whale, are you? Because people around here are superstitious about that kind of thing. You understand?" And it's just like, just things that people never say.
Yeah,
another one is Charlotte Rampling in like the early scene where he's building the pen.
The harpoon he has is really cool as well, that big harpoon he has. I really like that.
Oh, the one he uses towards the end.
Yeah, towards the end, it's got the kind of curved blade on it. And I was like, if I had a harpoon, I want it to look like that.
Yeah, that's great. There is a bit of a flaw in the ending in that he kind of goes into this, it's going to be a fair fight.
It's not.
Yeah. I'm not going to use guns. I'll just use this harpoon. He throws the harpoon once and then he picks up a gun. No, not really. And to be fair, on the other hand, I think one man versus whale is never going to be fair.
It's not going to be fair, ever.
In the wrong way for him. But there's also, Charlotte Rampling, when she finds out that this is what he's doing, she says to him, "Lots of bad luck." And then there's Jacob Omelak. I mean, he can kind of gets away with it because he's the kind of cliched Native American character that even if the writers were white Americans, they would probably write dialogue just as bad for him.
Yes.
But his first line is, "She speaks to you the truth." And then Richard Harris looks at him and he goes, "She knows it from the university. I know it from my ancestors."
I remember that now.
And by the way, Will Sampson, I think we should have mentioned, he's a really interesting presence. He's the big guy from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's
Nest. Is that him?
I know him from three films. Poltergeist 2 he's in as well.
Ah, Poltergeist 2.
He's always a really interesting presence.
He does carry a bit of like gravitas. I should like to mention.
Minchin.
So that's a small mention. It's a minchin.
Blimey, I think we've covered everything.
Can I ask you one last thing before? I want to go into the listener kind of Twitterati and what they have to say.
All right.
But first of all, the last question I want to ask is, why do you think this movie has such a small fan base, or why do you think the general public are not so aware of it?
I think that it was probably lost in the torrent of, like you say, Jawsploitation movies that came out in the 70s. Only the very, very, very best of those films have any kind of afterlife now, like Piranha, Joe Dante's Piranha.
Yeah, I love
it. Because it got a sequel, it recently got a remake, and it's good. It's really good. I love it.
It's a fun.
I think I saw
that before I saw Jaws.
Right, okay. I mean, it still worked, wouldn't it? Whereas I think there's so many of these kind of films that it was torrential in a similar way to like the slasher boom that we were talking about on the podcast.
Definitely.
So many of them came out that you probably wouldn't remember that many. I mean, I think it's significant that only about a year after this came out, maybe less than a year, Jaws 2 came out.
Yeah.
And Jaws 2 has a massive go at Orca. In return for like Orca starting off with the shark being killed and like way better than Jaws. Jaws 2 has a dead killer whale on the beach. and like Chief Brody is like, "My God, what killed this thing?"
Yeah.
You know? So I also think the fact that he It got pretty terrible reviews at the time. Yeah. I think even at the time, people were aware that the music was lovely. But apart from that, it was fairly bad reviews. I think Harris was quite regretful of having done it.
Mm.
So it's not got a kind of critical respectability that they're bringing it. But I do think it does have a cult afterlife among people who love kind of creature feature monster movies, which is the kind of stuff that drew me to it. It's just, I will investigate movies from that era, which I know are not meant to be very good, but I'll probably end up watching them anyway.
Mm.
Movies like the Giant Rabbits movie, Night of the Leaper.
I think I started watching that. I didn't finish it.
Right. And like Prophecy, which is giant mutant.
Bear?
Like grizzly bear. and there's absolutely loads, and there's various Bigfoot films and things like that. But I think you always want, I always enjoy seeing a monster, even when it's rubbish. And eventually a lot of them, when they're revealed, are rubbish. But Orca, because so much of it is real footage of real whales, stands up on a visual level. Yeah, I think it is undoubtedly true that tell the bits where it's, sometimes you can tell them models and the real fish and things like that. And by the way, I think there's so many good technical credits on this movie.
Hmm.
I think another one is the editors, John Bloom, Marion Rothman, and Ralph Winters.
Okay.
Ralph Winters cut King Kong for De Laurentiis. Marion Rothman did some of the Planet of the Apes film. And I think certainly sequences like where the killer whale kills the shark and throws it out of the water. If you can clearly see which bits are modeled.
Yeah.
But they cut it together in such a sharp way that
the editing is probably one of the stellar bits of it. So I think we've covered the film there. I don't think we're gonna be able to fit in the cult film test.
Okay.
I think we're running a little long, but I'm glad we've had so much to say about Orca, because that's even better. Because I thought with such a kind of basic premise, a simple plot, we might not have had that much to say. But I think we've gone way above and beyond what we needed.
I've always got stuff to say about movies like this.
You're just a fountain of knowledge, and I love that. And I hope all the listeners appreciate all the nuggets you've been giving out. So speaking of the listeners. So I've asked them two questions. I asked them what their favourite movie animal is, and I asked them what their favourite animal antagonist is. So a movie that features an animal antagonist. So I am Jack's regular movie musings at I Am Jack's Musings on Twitter. He said, Jaws is numero uno, but a certain fictional, I hope, breed of South American spiders had a massive impact on my film watching youth. So he's referencing arachnophobia. Yeah,
the Venezuelan jumping spider.
Yes,
it's one of my favourites. Absolutely. That movie was so terrifying I had to leave after 20 minutes.
It is quite scary. I think I'm going to do a podcast on that one in the future, I think, at some point.
Ooh, right.
So next
up, another one that's a clear riff on Jaws.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Next person was Marcus at the Marco Guy. Let's face it, as far as any animal antagonist movie goes, it's very hard to beat Jaws. We're moving on to the best animal movies or movie animals. Dan Burgess at Dan Burgess has said, Digby, the biggest dog in the world.
I'd love to see that. I've never seen it.
Neither have I.
I've seen clips of it and it looks kind of amazing.
Kind of looks like Clifford the Big Red Dog, but without the colour.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, there's a few big dog movies and made around the same time, and I'm not sure which is which. Digby, and there's
some other ones.
There's a couple of others.
Okay, so Robert at That Robster. Can I say Gizmo? He's an animal, right? I've always wanted one from Gremlins. I'm going to allow that.
Yeah.
It's a mammal. He's a mammal. I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah.
Moving on to Facebook quickly. Lee Anthony says, the 1990s Disney movie White Fang, I loved that wolf. Apparently the same wolf dog as the one in John Carpenter's The Thing, apparently.
I don't know. It's 10 years later.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Not sure about that one.
I don't know. It's a good film.
It is.
That book, it was one of my favourite John
Yeah, I remember there being quite a lot of adaptations of White Fang, like throughout the ages, and I think there was probably a cartoon, I think.
There's certainly a kind of direct-to-video sequel called White Fang 2, The Legend of the White Wolf.
Okay.
But,
White Fang 2, More Bite.
I was going to call it White Fang 2, The Lair of the White Worm would have been wrong in so many words.
He's got the white worms.
Oh dear,
he's not well. He's not a good dog. Maybe that's why Digby's so big. He's just full of shit. I don't know. And my frequent companion on here, Andy Knowles, Angry Andy Knowles, he's quoting, "It's freezing in here, Mr. Bigglesworth." From Austin Powers, obviously the cat, Dr. Evil's cat.
They get shot into space.
Blofeld, like, and he comes back. He's all fluffy in the first one, isn't he? Yeah. And he comes out and he's all like, it's hairless. But yeah, so that has been our podcast, another edition of Secret Defenders. Thank you again, Dan, for joining me on this maiden voyage. It's not maiden voyage, but it's a maiden voyage with yourself. So it is a
with
maiden...
me, you, and Captain Nolan.
Yes, we certainly have
done this voyage together.
We have.
Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honour. Thank you.
Oh, well, I hope you have me on your podcast very soon, because I would very much like that.
It is an absolute date, so we'll do that.
All right, take care, Dan. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.